Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 384, titled Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 4. This is being recorded on October 20th of the year 2002. In this broadcast, we've been taking a look at Borman Organization links to the arming of Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction, and I will, time permitting, give an overview of what I believe is going on vis-a-vis the Iraqi situation. I think many people have a hold of a particular piece of this elephant, but they don't have the whole thing. I believe, to make a long story short, it's kind of a let's you and him fight situation, and I think that the United States has been maneuvered into a situation in which we may very well be the victim of a trap that was conceptualized during the closing stages of World War II or in its immediate aftermath by a Third Reich that was in the process of going underground. I can appreciate that that is a concept that may appear outrageous, incredible, what have you. Sadly, it is documented. The book Serpent's Walk, that I believe is sort of the Turner Diaries for the Underground Reich, again, a book published by National Vanguard Books, in 1991, talks about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century. After worldwide economic and ecological destruction and political chaos bring the world to the verge of total conflict, the United States is hit with a bioterrorist attack of genetically engineered microorganisms of ostensibly Russian origin. This wipes out much of the U.S. population. Much of the rest of the world is wiped out as well. The martial law is declared in the United States, and the Underground Reich takes over. At the same time, Israel gets wiped out with a weapons of mass destruction attack. Of course, in Serpent's Walk, it's presented as something they deserve because they started the whole thing. And the Underground Reich takes over. Much of the Arab world and much of the Muslim world and much of Europe get wiped out as well. We will discuss that at greater length in the broadcast. As the war drums beat louder and as the dog is indeed being wagged, I think it's worth bearing in mind a number of things about the last Persian Gulf War. First of all, as I've talked about in many programs, including For the Record 174, 248, and in For the Record 347, it was the elder George Bush, or George I as I call him, who presided over not only the arming of Iran in the Iran-Contra affair, one of the three elements of the axis of evil that his son identified in early 2002 in his State of the Union speech, but also, and perhaps under the circumstances even more importantly, the elder George Bush presided over the arming of Iraq under the BNL/Iraqgate scandal. One of the things that Saddam Hussein was equipped with under this clandestine arming program, most of which came from Germany, but a lot of which came from the United States as well. One of the things that Saddam Hussein apparently came up with was a weaponized microorganism called a mycoplasma, which in turn had been weaponized through the apparent splicing of a gene from the AIDS virus into the mycoplasma. This weaponized organism was therefore much more pathogenic and much more difficult for the immune system to deal with. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt of For the Record program number 16, recorded exactly 6 years ago today on October 20th, 1996. This is a long 3-hour broadcast in which I interviewed four live guests, Drs. Alan Cantwell and Leonard Horowitz, both of whom have done research on AIDS as a biological weapon, were my guests live in the studio. Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, was our guest via telephone hookup. And in the concluding portion of the broadcast, Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some very important work on the role of this genetically engineered mycoplasma in Gulf War syndrome, something that appears to have multiple causes. But Dr. Garth Nicholson joined us, and he talked about the Gulf War syndrome, the genetically engineered mycoplasma, and related subjects. And this is something to think about in connection with the impending venture, perhaps, into Iraq. So again, this is Dr. Garth Nicholson, now of the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Irvine, California. He joined us late in the broadcast on October 20th, 1996. This again from For the Record Program 16. And it's my pleasure to introduce a fourth guest this evening. This is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some very important and fascinating research concerning a possible biological warfare component to the Persian Gulf War syndrome. Dr. Nicholson, welcome to our program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on.
Dr. Nicholson, along with your wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, you have been doing research into some of the causes of Persian Gulf War syndrome, something that's very much in the news these days. And in some of the papers you've written, you've attributed that syndrome to a number of different causes, including a organism called a mycoplasma. Could you tell us a little bit about what a mycoplasma is and what makes this particular mycoplasma special and how you came across it?
Well, it's a very simple microorganism, very similar to a bacteria. It's not very complex in terms of the biologic systems that we normally deal with, but it's more complex than a virus. So it has genetic information in it, and what we found is that in about one-half of the Gulf War illness patients that we've looked at, there's a very unusual type of microorganism, a mycoplasma, found deep inside their white blood cells. And this unusual form of mycoplasma has an inserted gene in it from the HIV-1 virus, the AIDS-causing virus. And it's very interesting because the gene that we found in it is exactly the type of gene that you'd put in this if you wanted to make a biologic weapon. Because this is the gene that encodes an envelope glycoprotein called GP120, and this is the component that's a receptor that allows this microorganism, we think, to attach to cells and enter cells, just like the AIDS virus enters your cells.
Now, Dr. Horowitz has written about the mechanism by which the virus enters the cells as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how this, in words, explain for the layperson how the HIV or this apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma enters the cells?
Well, we think it uses a variety of receptors, mainly a receptor complex called the CD4 receptor complex. And it attaches to this and then is taken in what's known as an endocytotic vesicle inside the cell. And then it gets loose from that, and then the genetic information gets into the cell and goes into the nucleus, essentially, eventually. And that's basically how it enters. It's much more complex than that, but I think for your listening audience, that will suffice.
So in other words, this mechanism, which is on this mycoplasma, actually enables the organism to enter into a cell's wall.
Well, that's what we think. We think it allows it to penetrate inside the cell, and that's what makes this particular microorganism so insidious, because once it's in the cell, it can use its metabolism more or less to poison the cell, and this causes a tremendous amount of problems. And also, when it divides inside the cell and is released eventually from the cell, it can take a little piece of membrane with it, and this sets up kind of an immune response against cells. So it actually can trigger an autoimmune response, and we often see in these Gulf War illness patients very unusual autoimmune symptoms, very similar to MS, ALS, Graves' disease, for example, lupus, but they don't have these rare genetic diseases. In fact, we see some symptoms, combination of different diseases in the same patient. And all of these seem to go away when we treat with the appropriate antibiotics. So we don't think that these soldiers really had these unusual genetic diseases. We think that the mycoplasma may have caused these signs and symptoms which mimic these genetic diseases.
And in an historical element, how did you first come across this organism?
Well, we got involved in this because our stepdaughter was served in Operation Desert Storm. She was a crew chief on a Black Hawk helicopter involved in the deep insertions into Iraq. And when she came back, she slowly came down with a chronic illness that we couldn't explain. It was very unusual, and there were so many different signs and symptoms. There were 30 or 40 different signs and symptoms, and then we slowly started to get it, and we noticed when we called around to several of her colleagues and so on that not only did they have the disease, but also their family members were starting to come down with it. So we knew that we weren't dealing with a chemical weapon. We were probably dealing with a biologic weapon that she picked up in Operation Desert Storm. Now, we trace this down just by going through these complex signs and symptoms, going back to the medical literature, trying to figure out what it might be. And we ruled out a lot of different diseases, which are more acute in nature, tried to settle on some of the chronic illnesses and what they might be caused by. And then we finally settled on mycoplasmas as a possibility. And sure enough, when we did the genetic testing, that's exactly what we found.
In your opinion, how did these troops become infected with this, or are you in a position to say?
Well, we've actually, in our testimony to the U.S. Congress, we've stated that there are four possible ways in which they were exposed. The first is that some of them may have gotten contaminated vaccines. And mycoplasmal contamination of vaccines is not uncommon because often they're made in animals, and animals are just as susceptible to humans in picking up these mycoplasmal infections. The second is that there were certain areas in the desert, which we call exclusionary zones, in which the Iraqis may have actually placed chemical and biologic weapons, both by spraying them and by releasing them. And the military intelligence units that were deep in Iraq ran across some of these areas. They found that everything human and animal was dead in these areas. And so that's the second way. And the third is a more popular notion now, although when we presented it, it really did not receive any press at all, and that's the blowback from destroyed bunkers and factories which contain chemical and biologic weapons. And as you know, the press has picked up on this recently, and now they've indicated that it's very likely that at least 15,000 soldiers were exposed to nerve agents and other chemical agents when they blew up these bunkers, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, they blew up hundreds of these bunkers and also a variety of different factories as well that had the biologic agents and chemical agents. And these could have been blown back across our lines because the prevailing winds during the time of the conflict were from northeast to southwest. So this would have carried all these agents back across our lines. And they would have been diluted, so they're probably in low level, and that would have explained why there weren't a large number of immediate signs and symptoms on the battlefield. It took some time after they returned home. And then finally, the Scud missiles that rained down on Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, western Kuwait, for example, these often were manned, or they were tipped with skyburst warheads. So instead of using a high-explosive warhead, some of the warheads were low-yield warheads that blew up at 2,000 to 5,000 feet in the air, and they had dispersing capabilities, so they dispersed kind of a mist all over the battlefield, and this was described by a number of units, particularly reserve units behind the lines. And those units that were under Scud attack, they have very high casualties now, so there's not a uniform degree of casualties among the various units. It was very deployment-dependent, and some of the units that were hardest hit were way behind the lines that were under Scud attack, so we think that may have played a very important role as well.
Later on in For the Record 16, again from 10-20-96, Dr. Nicholson further developed his point about the genetically engineered mycoplasma and had this discussion supplemented by some of our other medical guests.
You've been talking about family members of Gulf War veterans getting these diseases. I believe also in some of your literature you mentioned that VA hospital physicians are getting them.
That's correct. We're getting, for the first time now, telephone calls from nursing and physician staff members in Veterans Administration hospitals and military hospitals that are coming down with this because they work in Gulf War illness referral units.
How many GIs have died, do you think?
Well, the estimates, and we don't have hard numbers on this, are between 12 and 15,000.
Yeah, these are veterans who've died of Gulf War syndrome?
Well, these are veterans who've died of unusual diseases since Operation Desert Storm. And by the way, there are a couple thousand of those that have died of cancers. And there are a lot of very unusual cancers represented, spinal cord cancers, brain tumors and stuff. And remember, this is an age group under 25, and you don't expect to see those types of cancers at such high frequency.
There are what, only 200-300 GIs actually killed in combat?
148, according to official records. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. There were some immediate casualties that weren't reported, and we found that out from Graves Registry units. And these immediate casualties are probably due to nerve agents or anthrax or something of that type, which had much more acute signs and symptoms. And they were, by the way, taken away, and often their dates of death were changed from what we heard. So they were doing a lot of very funny things during Operation Desert Storm, and if people found out about it, I think they'd be really shocked.
That, again, from For the Record Program 16, recorded exactly 6 years ago today, October 20th of 1996. Bear in mind that it appears that Gulf War has multiple causes. Gulf War syndrome has multiple causes. Some of the injections that were given to soldiers have appeared to affect people. There also have been some indications that the various pollutants such as the petroleum fires that were burning in Kuwait may have contributed to this. But certainly one of the elements that contributed to Gulf War syndrome was this genetically engineered mycoplasma, sadly something that is treatable and that has apparently not received a lot of discussion. Bearing in mind where Saddam Hussein's wee beasties came from, and they came from Germany and from the Reagan-Bush administration, both basically extensions of the underground Reich, with the Bormann organization pulling the strings of power in both institutions, it is worth contemplating just where the United States is going. Bear in mind, too, the book Serpent's Walk that I spoke about. It is what I believe the Underground Reich is planning. It is, like the book The Turner Diaries, a teaching tool, a blueprint, a manifesto. The Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk are published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic Nazi group in the United States, and a group with strong connections to German Nazis and apparently also to the Underground Reich. In Serpent's Walk, the United States is devastated in the mid-21st century by a biological warfare attack of ostensibly Russian origin using genetically engineered microorganisms. Much of the population is wiped out, in particular the population of the coasts. Martial law is declared and the Underground Reich takes over the United States. Much of the rest of the world's population is destroyed at the same time. Israel ultimately is wiped off the face of the earth by weapons of mass destruction, and much of the Arab world is destroyed as well. Now, again, that is not necessarily something that appears to be that far afield, so if there are people who think that my discussion of Serpent's Walk in the past is off base, might want to reflect on that at greater length. Something to contemplate as well is the fact, and I will put a couple of articles referencing this, what I'm about to say has been relatively well documented, but the CIA has been at loggerheads with the Bush administration. The CIA said that it is not necessarily evident that Saddam Hussein has been equipping terrorist groups with weapons of mass destruction or working with them. And the Bush administration has been arguing against that. At the same time, the CIA has cautioned that if the United States were to destroy Saddam Hussein, or if he felt his destruction was imminent, that he might very well be equipping terrorist groups with weapons of mass destruction. I would also note in that regard that it has been bruited about that Israel has unqualified support for the attack on Saddam Hussein. That is not necessarily the case either. In fact, many Israelis feel that further provoking the Arab world and basically precipitating a retaliation against Israel would not be in that country's best interest. So I would take that with a grain of salt. There was a front page article in the LA Times last week about that. But considering the serpent's walk scenario, considering the Third Reich heritage of Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party that we've spoken about in the past, considering the Third Reich underground Reich heritage of the Bush family that we've spoken about in the past, considering the Thiessen firm's role in the arming of Saddam Hussein and the equipping of Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction, considering the Bormann Group's role in that very same situation, and bearing in mind, again, the Bush heritage of the U.S. element in arming Saddam Hussein, it's worth considering the Serpent's Walk scenario in some detail. I feel that the United States may very well be walking into a trap, as I've indicated, that was conceptualized perhaps even during the closing stages of World War II or in its immediate aftermath. And I believe that provoking a conflict between the United States and involving Israel and world Jewry and the Muslim population of the world, in particular the Arab population and those Muslims living in what the Nazis called the Earth Island, a concept I've introduced in the past, that stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, Eurasia, most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, China, India, and Pakistan. That area involves most of the world's landmass, most of its population, most of its petroleum reserves, and across the middle of it is a vast stretch of Muslim population. This was not lost on the Nazi geopoliticians, and I believe that sometime in the middle of the last century, provoking a war between the United States, which they hated, and the world's Jewish population, Israel was not yet in existence, and the Muslim population of the world, and in particular affecting a retaliatory annihilation between the Arabs on the one hand and the Jews and the United States on the other, was seen by the Underground Reich as a very, very good way of effecting world conquest. They realized they didn't have enough troops to do it on their own. There would be too much bloodshed. And with the massive destruction that Germany experienced in World War II, it was simply viewed as not viable to accomplish world conquest through force of German arms. However, in a let's you and him fight scenario, sort of a geopolitical Armageddon-like Punch and Judy show where you've got these two puppets bashing each other to bits, but with the puppet master controlling the strings behind the scene, that, I believe, is what we're looking at in Iraq. And I believe that many of the scenarios that have been advanced are accurate ones. Bear in mind that both Saddam Hussein and much of the Arab population and the Bush administration appear to be manipulated by the Underground Reich. On the one hand, the wag the dog scenario I believe to be valid in order to maintain political power in the United States for the time being. Keeping Bush in power would be seen as essential. All other elements of discussion appear to have been pushed off of the political table. On the other hand, mobilizing the Jewish vote on behalf of George Bush, something the Jews should know better than, but who knows, and also pissing off the rest of the human race against the United States would be a very, very good thing to do and appears to be something that is successfully being done. Consider Serpent's Walk against the following background. This is an article from the LA Times, actually an op-ed piece, that appeared in the second week in October. I neglected to note the date. I will have that in the annotated description of the program. This was from page A13 of their op-ed section. I will have the precise date for the description. But again, this is from the Los Angeles Times in the second week of October of 2002. This is an article by Scott P. Lane and Michael H. Zummer. Scott P. Lane is an associate professor of epidemiology at the UCLA School of Public Health. Michael H. Zummer is a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley and a visiting fellow at Yale University. This column is titled A Virus-Fed Doomsday, subtitled Bio-Armageddon is a Possibility if the U.S. Hits Hussein. It reads in part as follows. The debate among the nation's politicians and the advice they're receiving from intelligence experts should not focus exclusively on diplomacy versus preemptive military action against Saddam Hussein. Instead, there is one nightmarish outcome, the so-called bio-Armageddon scenario, that is of immediate concern. It goes like this. We go in to take out Hussein, and his obedient henchmen pull a doomsday switch, releasing contagious biological agents for which there is no vaccine and no cure. Not only are hundreds of thousands of American troops wiped out, but if Saddam Hussein wishes to die a martyr's death, the virulent agents are released to spread around the world and wipe out half of mankind. Even mentioning this subject may seem like scaremongering, but it's not. In today's dicey world, this horrific possibility is a biological, military, and political fact of life or death that cannot be dismissed out of hand. How seriously has the bio-Armageddon scenario been weighed in councils of war? An October 7th letter from CIA Director George Tenet to Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, stated that a cornered Hussein might use, quote, his last chance to exact vengeance by taking a large number of victims with him, unquote. It costs about $1 million to kill one person with a nuclear weapon, about $1,000 to kill one person with a chemical weapon, and about $1 to kill one person with a biological weapon. Low cost alone may dictate that current and future terrorists will opt for the $1 biological killers. Last year, a bombshell of a scientific paper published in the Journal of Virology revealed that a bioengineered form of mousepox, a close cousin of smallpox, was vaccine resistant and 100% lethal. It showed that simply inserting one immune-inhibiting gene into mousepox was all it took. Is it conceivable that Hussein's well-trained scientists, who crave to please their boss at any cost, have not read this paper and applied its findings to smallpox? This year, another stunning paper in the research journal Science described the complete synthesis of the poliovirus genome in the test tube. This feat of bioengineering pointed out that deadly viruses such as smallpox can be resurrected in the test tube. No seed germs are required, as previously thought, just genetic sequences, training in molecular biology at the master's in science level, and a few years of laboratory work. It's hard to underestimate or sugarcoat these scientific papers. They offer a blueprint for creating vaccine-resistant and highly lethal viruses that could, for example, render the current smallpox vaccine stockpile and the U.S. government's emergency vaccination program absolutely useless. This biological genie may pose a far greater threat than 1,000 atomic bombs. It's no longer hypothetical to bioengineer such an agent, and less than $1 million would be required to create deadly and contagious agents. In the wrong hands, a bioengineered virus could be bottled and used as an insurance policy against invasion and overthrow. And if unleashed, it could change the very fabric of remaining modern civilization. Indeed, that is the Serpent's Walk scenario. There will be a detailed annotated description, including the date for that LA Times op-ed column, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week of the airing of this program. That is at www.spitfirelist.com. It's equipped with real audio, and it's linked to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU that have the entire For the Record series online at this point. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs, including For the Record 155, 87, and 16 that you heard excerpted here, are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the Spitfire and WFMU.org/Dave Emery websites. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 384, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 4, being recorded on October 20th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.